Good afternoon. My name is Ashley, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Compliance with the Joint Commission's Emergency Management Standards and Lessons Learned from the Frontline on September 11th conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. I will now turn the conference over to Lauren Sillis from Premiering. Ma'am, you may begin your conference.
Oh, thank you, Ashley. And I want to say good afternoon to everyone from a beautiful spring sunny day in Charlotte, North Carolina. You've called into the Premier's Advisor Live series. I've got a couple quick announcements I'm going to make before we turn the call over to Steve Sponbrook. He's from Premier's Consulting Services. As stated by Ashley, this teleconference is being recorded, and it will be posted to the Advisor Live homepage at premierinc.com within about 24 hours. Following today's presentations, the operator will tell you how to ask questions. I'm also going to open up the chat box, which you'll be able to locate on your monitor. So if you don't want to wait in line and ask a question, you can go ahead and email it to me via the chat box, and I'll make sure to get it included. After this call, I'm going to send you just a quick email that will give you directions on how to access the presentation, the audio portion, and also whatever other attachments are available from today's program. I've also got a link in there to a brief survey. I would really appreciate you taking a little 2 minutes of your time and letting us know how we did and giving us ideas for future topics. I think that covers the announcements. Again, thank you for participating, and I'm going to turn the call over to Steve. Steve, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Thank you very much, Lauren. If you want to go ahead and go to the first slide, my name is Steve Sponbrook, and I'm a director in Premier Consulting Services, focusing primarily on facilities consulting in the areas of environmental care. So I've been dealing with the Joint Commission for about 16 years now, basically on a full-time basis. And what Lauren had asked me to do is really just introduce what the Joint Commission is doing in terms of their standards and where they're headed in terms of emphasis and that sort of thing. And like a lot of things with the Joint Commission, it goes up and down and back and forth. But just to sort of bring you up to speed on the history of emergency management, at least where we are today, going as far back as 2000 is when the Joint Commission really started talking in terms of an all-hazards approach to emergency management, getting away from the traditional methodology where there was an expectation that a hospital would have a detailed, very specific emergency plan for each type of foreseeable disaster or event that could occur. Rather than that, they borrowed this really from the California model and said that it makes more sense to have a good command and control structure in place with well-trained incident commanders and staff and chiefs of different areas so that decisions could be made rapidly and resources could be allocated appropriately. That started in 2000, and they really did not emphasize that very much. A lot of hospitals took a long time to transition from the old methodology, and in fact, there's some that are still struggling with that, frankly, to get to this all-hazards plan. Of course, 9/11 changed a lot of things. One of the things was it really increased the emphasis from a survey standpoint on emergency management. Prior to that, frankly, a lot of the surveys, emergency management was almost an afterthought as a part of the environment of care, or even before those days, the plant technology and safety management days, for those of you old enough to remember that. They really just would review a couple of drills and ask one or two questions, and that was the extent of the survey. Post 9/11, they really started looking at hospitals, the way they were preparing, the way they were training their staff, what types of things they were doing to ramp up for, in those days, mass casualty and terrorism-like events. And in fact, that's when they were really pushing the decontamination piece. Of course, you know, events really lead to where the Joint Commission goes with their standards and their focus, and Hurricane Katrina was one of the most dramatic events that have happened in recent years. And that led to a lot of changes within environment care standards and emergency management in particular, one of which is they began developing or requiring the emergency operations plan. And this really, if you look at the emergency operations plan and what they're asking you to do, which is to go through and create a single emergency operations plan that covers all of the foreseeable events that you may have in your organization. It's almost a throwback to the prior 2000 days. They still expect you to have an all-hazards plan, but they want this emergency operations plan in place. And just for clarification, I talked with the Joint Commission not too terribly long ago about this and said, do you really expect to find, a three-inch, three-ring binder with this, multi-page plan? And they said, absolutely. And the response that I got, which I'm still not comfortable with, but what they said to me in terms of justification was that if the surveyors find that emergency operations plan in place in a facility with a detailed response to every one of the elements of performance in the emergency management chapter, they know at least someone within the organization has taken the time to look at each one of those in detail. To me, that was a cop-out, but that's where we are today. Here in 2009, emergency management has become its own chapter separate from the environment of care. One of the primary reasons for that, according to the Joint Commission, was to elevate it in terms of importance and to illustrate to the entire organization that emergency management was an organization-wide responsibility. Or you can go ahead and move to the next slide if you don't mind. A few things about how the process has changed in terms of the way they're surveying. And again, as I said earlier, in the old days, emergency management was really just a small portion of the overall environment care survey process. Now there's a separate emergency management tracer. It typically takes an hour and a half to 2 hours. It's led by one of the survey team members, and it really resembles a tabletop exercise. They refer to it as a tracer, but it essentially is a tabletop exercise. Most often they will pick a scenario. It's very, very surveyor dependent. I was telling my colleagues earlier in this call that I've had probably half a dozen surveys this year, and each one has been different. In fact, some of the surveyors have chosen a case study which they have available to them prepared by the Joint Commission and stuck with that scenario throughout the surveyor tracer. Others have taken a scenario, started with that, and then actually changed scenarios midstream to make sure that they actually hit every element of performance in the emergency management chapter, which is a much more effective way of surveying the facility. But they also spend time reviewing key documents in terms of drill critiques and also this emergency operations plan. Have not gotten a lot of feedback from the surveyors on the EOP itself. I do know they're being reviewed. I know that they've reviewed some that were very, very detailed and some that were not quite as detailed or not quite as good from my perspective, and have not had a lot of feedback on either one. Where most of that feedback is occurring is during that tracer process, and it can go from being, like I said, a tabletop exercise that occurs in the boardroom and stays there, from actually starting there and touring through the facility once it starts and bringing people in to see where the incident command center is, what happens in the ED, et cetera. Again, it's totally surveyor dependent. One other thing that's a change that's not highly publicized, but God forbid if you're in a situation where you have an event like this, the Joint Commission will send a team from the central office out to your organization to evaluate your response, primarily to learn ways to improve emergency management planning. So it's almost like a sentinel event or sentinel event alert. The idea, and they did this post-Katrina, when they sent the team to New Orleans, they downloaded as much information as they could about the response, and that led to some of the changes that we're seeing in the standards now. And you can go ahead and move to the next slide, Lauren. Some of the major components in the emergency management chapter that at least I think ought to be discussed in terms of clarification, one of which, the hazard vulnerability analysis, which is the document that's been around since, I believe, 2000, where they required us to go through and say, here are the things that are most likely to occur within our facility, our community, and here is what the impact and how well we're prepared are, and we use that in order to generate a priority list for making changes and improving our emergency preparedness. They expect that to be done with the community now, so that not only we understand our capabilities and what our risks are and our vulnerabilities are, but we also understand the broader community's capabilities in relation to ours. That can be challenging depending on the community. Some communities really embrace this opportunity. Others are very, very difficult. And the only thing I can say is just make every effort that you can to ensure that you've got this cooperation with the community. If you don't, document it as best you can. Another element of performance speaks to having strategies for mitigation, preparedness, response, and recovery for each item on your HVA. That's a little bit unrealistic. What the Joint Commission is saying unofficially is they really expect you to have that for the top three items on your HVA. But suffice it to say what's important is those items that your high likelihood of occurrence, you should have these types of plans in place. You know, the first one is what can you do to reduce the risk should the event occur? You know, what do you do to prepare? What's your response plan? But the one that's most frequently overlooked, and this is fairly consistent from the organizations that I survey and the ones that I've been involved in with the actual Joint Commission surveys, this is recovery piece. And that's something that if you talk to anybody that went through Katrina, the recovery part was the longest part of this whole process. Another component is communicating outside with outside agencies on patient-related information and having processes in place so that you can provide that information quickly and accurately. And that not only includes the FBI and state health, but other healthcare organizations in the area that you may turn to for support. Staff and family support is a big one. Touro Medical Center, when they were in the middle of Katrina, I think they had 200 patients, but 1,400 people, or maybe it was 1,200 people that were in the facility at the time. So what you may be called upon to actually provide resources for in terms of numbers may be well beyond what your licensed beds are, what your surge capacity is. So something to keep in mind. Having plans in place for sharing resources across healthcare organizations, not only in the community, but the extended community, is something else in the standards and also a very good idea. The Comprehensive Emergency Operations Plan I've already talked about, and I don't want to go into a lot of detail on that, but again, that's something, a document that should have been prepared last year. A lot of the organizations that I'm working with right now are still struggling to put this in place, and so if you're up for a survey anytime soon, you really want to put a priority into that. There's sections within that plan that speak to security measures, safety measures, hazardous materials being one. In fact, how are you going to deal with the hazardous materials that you're going to generate during this disaster, assuming that you're going to be on your own for an extended period of time? What are you going to do to maintain security? What about essential utility systems, staffing, those human resource needs that you may have? And, of course, the broader part of this call is going to talk about some of these management resources. And I'm going to turn it over to Jim here. But the biggest piece here, and I think the thing that a lot of people are really, really struggling with, is this 96 hours of self-sufficiency and what that actually means. And if you read the element of performance, it's very specific. It says when the community can no longer support the organization. Now, they're surveying that in various ways. Some surveyors will say if you have a vendor that's within your community, then that would be okay. That actually is not what the element of performance states. So you're rolling dice if you're determining that because this vendor is only 2 miles away, we can rely on them during a disaster. Having lived through a couple of hurricanes, I can tell you 2 miles can be, might as well be across the ocean. The big issue here with this 96 hours of self-sufficiency is understanding what your capabilities are. When will you run out of resources? When will you no longer be able to support the patients that you currently have in the building, plus those that you may receive as a result of whatever it is, whether it's a mass casualty, whether it's some type of natural disaster? That's what's really key. And beyond that, having a plan for when that ultimately happens and you get beyond that point of self-sufficiency, how are you going to safely evacuate those patients and your staff, and then what will you do with the building after you're done? So with that, I'll turn it over to Jim.
Okay, well, thank you so much. Steve, you did a phenomenal job at giving the overall picture and just how complex the standards are. And I'd like to thank Premier for taking a very proactive approach in providing this this audio conference today and for supporting the effort of a healthcare emergency management. I'm just going to be covering the medical resources today, but like Steve said, you have security, you have staffing, you have a whole myriad of issues that the Joint Commission will be looking at. So today I'll just cover these. And just touching all planning tasks, basically. For the first one, it's, Lauren, if you on the first slide? Sorry about that. In the emergency operations plan, the organization prepares for how it will manage resources and assets during emergencies. And all planning tasks are supported by the hazard vulnerability assessment process. And there is some confusion on that because a lot of times people think if they do a hospital healthcare vulnerability assessment, then that's all I need to do. But you'll see in the this year and future years that what they're looking for is, of course, you do a hospital HVA to take a look at what vulnerabilities your plant has or your staffing call down lists. If there are vulnerabilities there, you want to take a look at those. But you need to know what types of events, planning scenarios, that I'm going to be responsible for putting into my emergency operation plan and for how I'm going to deal with those planning scenarios. And that's where you get it from the jurisdiction. The Emergency Management Agency has done a hazard vulnerability assessment where they look at the top 3 to 5 events that are most likely to befall that community. And, of course, the healthcare organization will be dealing with those. And so the emergency operation plan should detail how the organization will manage each of the top 3 to 5 likely events and the casualties which are generated from each event. And a lot of times I'll get a question like, well, how do I know how many casualties? Well, if one of your planning scenarios indicates it will be a Madrid or London-style terrorist multiple bombings of subways or that type of thing or public transportation, you can look at those kind of the casualties from their after action reports that were generated, and that would give you a guess. But the most important thing to remember here is it's always going to be an estimate, and your estimate's going to be just as good as mine or anybody else's. You just try to do a reasonable job in researching what numbers and what are the distribution of injuries in these types of events. Okay, next slide. Materials manager roles. I don't think ever in history we've seen an increase in a role of an individual in the healthcare environment as we're seeing here with the materials management or the materials manager. And in the thing that the paradigm that Steve alluded to was the hospital incident command system. They actually have a logistics chief. That's the medical materials manager, or the supply chain manager would be filling that position. During normal operations, there's a lot of advance work under the preparedness portion, which is establish agreements with local and regional distributors, meet projected needs for resources and assets to address emergency scenarios. Every contract for every vendor that you have needs to have a sub-paragraph that talks about what the prime vendors, what the suppliers are going to do to make sure that you are resupplied and you have a durable supply chain throughout emergencies. Because we all know, once the supplies and equipment run out, then so does healthcare. And then that starts a cascade which ends up with the community losing its healthcare asset, and a bunch of people losing their jobs, and a lot of times the facility will never come back. I'll talk about that if I have a minute toward the end. The materials manager should be chairing the requirements working group, and I'll just say here that for that requirements working group, I sent Lauren Solis a requirements worksheet that I put together, and she said she will put that up on the website and she'll probably address that. But I think that's going to be real helpful to you. And there's the events that I put up there were for chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, and high-yield explosives. But if your hazard vulnerability assessment that's coming back from your community says that you're going to be looking at a hurricane, just take one of those other ones out and that are not a likely scenario and replace it with the hurricane and just go right down that items list. There's the numbers, a couple hundred supply item numbers on there and descriptions. And maintain an inventory of resources and assets available to the facility. More than ever before, the emergency manager will be looked to bolster the facility and to sustain it during disasters and through the recovery period. Lauren, next slide. some of the elements of performance under the resources is the emergency operation plan describes how the hospital will obtain and replenish medications and related supplies required through the response and recovery phases of an emergency. And this is what taps into those preparedness type of things the emergency manager needs to do to make sure that the, and we're talking about here medications primarily, pharmaceutical prime vendor, and if there's if there are some items that the prime vendor does not supply the hospital with or the healthcare system with, then the suppliers that do provide those outliers, they need to have the same type of thing, and that is what kind of procedures does the prime vendor or do the suppliers have in place to redeploy pharmaceuticals and immunizations and other items from out-of-area distribution centers. In other words, how do they redeploy their stocks to keep you operational during the disaster? And a lot of hospitals have agreed to take what they call ChemPacks from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the healthcare organization with those ChemPacks should probably talk to the public health or CDC, they call them the SNS coordinators or the ChemPack coordinators, and find out what are the ordering procedures for replenishment if you have a chemical event in one of your likely scenarios that was gathered from your hazard vulnerability assessment. Healthcare organizations share pharmaceutical requirements for each HVA planning scenario with the prime vendor. Again, this is where we get into what Steve was talking about, the 96 hours thing, and there's been some confusion about that. 96 hours is 4 days of unassisted backed up, if you will, supplies for your healthcare organization. Now, a lot of folks are saying, okay, my normal usage in one day is this, so times that by four, and that's the right level. Well, if you go back to your these likely events that were identified in the hazard vulnerability assessment, you'll notice that the consumption rates for supplies in a disaster look nothing like your normal consumption rates. So that presents a problem. And what I would think is that you would want to put in procedures whereby there would be an immediate release. These items that for your 96 hours would be identified and they would be ready for immediate release as a disaster starts to unfold. And if it looks like you're far enough away from your distributor that maybe that can't happen, then you might have to just look at building up an inventory. The problem with this is our normal healthcare operations is going toward leaner and leaner inventories, and at the same time, Joint Commission is saying you should have 96 hours of medical supplies, pharmaceuticals, vaccines, and everything else that you would need to meet those likely scenarios. And so there is a bit of a log jam there as to which one of those is going to end up. But it's a real problem. Let's put it that way, and it's going to have to be adjudicated. My guess would be get yourself a startup for the first several hours until you can get resupplied. But your vendors and your prime vendors and your other suppliers, those folks need to have plans where they would release that immediately and maybe even have other types of resupply for you via such as teaming with the National Guard for helicopter airlift to your hospitals. But the bottom line is you're going to need to think about being practicing without a lot of additional support. And that's why I'll be talking about other things as far as the kinds of things your prime vendor and your other suppliers need to do, and that is to bolster their own networks from their other distribution centers. Healthcare organization coordinates with public health strategic national stockpile manager for stock list of available antidote, pharmaceutical, and other SNS supplies. I would talk to your public health CDC or strategic national stockpile coordinator. It wouldn't hurt to speak with both those. Sometimes the public health coordinator is called the bioterrorism coordinator. So that may help you in getting in touch with the right people. But from there, that person can tie you into the SNS, Strategic National Stockpiles Project Officer. Practice ordering stock during disaster exercise to test prime vendor and suppliers. I'm not sure if the Joint Commission are requiring that right now and put a time clock on. Go ahead and order something that you normally don't stock to see how long it would take for your prime vendor or your other suppliers to get that item to you, but that may be a coming attraction. Lauren, next slide, please. Element Performance 2. The emergency operation plan describes how the hospital will obtain and replenish medical supplies required through response and recovery phases of an emergency. And in the emergency operation plan, they'll be looking for those supplier contracts to see that there are emergency resupply procedures, including your supplier and your prime vendor. How are they going to redeploy stocks from out-of-area distribution centers into their distribution center so that they can sustain you during disasters for the long term, which could be 2 weeks, 3 weeks, you know, not just 96 hours. Healthcare organization shares requirements for each HVA planning scenario with the prime vendor and all vendors. That's a little redundant, but that is, I think that's the crux of the whole thing, is that they need to know what kinds of supplies that you're going to be needing. They're going to want to see that worksheet that you put together for the requirements, from that, then they should be able to work with you in terms of putting together an operations plan for how they're going to keep you in business when the disaster starts unfolding. Next slide, please. The prime vendor has sufficient stock on hand to meet the requirements for 96 hours of emergency consumption rates. That's kind of the way I would go, but I would have basically a startup inventory, and then I would have my 96 hours identified with the prime vendor or your suppliers or both, you know, and have those ready to be pulled and sent to you immediately. That may do it. I can't tell you for sure it will, but I can tell you pretty sure that when you look at the consumption rates of supplies that you're going to need for disaster consumption rates, that you're probably going to run into a problem with your chief financial officer in bringing that much inventory into the house. So we're going the wrong way in our normal operations, making it leaner and leaner. They want to get down to having a stockless inventory, and here's Joint Commission saying you should have 96 hours of very considerable consumption rates of all the supplies that you've identified for each of your three top planning scenarios. We're in for it. If needed, healthcare organization purchases vendor-managed inventory. There is a possibility that you could place into your grant program, your grant submission to your public health department for the hospital preparedness program, where you could put in a certain dollar figure, we'll say maybe $1 million, that your health system would use to buy a vendor-managed inventory and to pay for the annual care and feeding of that inventory that's yours at your prime vendor site. And people will ask, how do I know that they're not going to give my inventory to somebody else? And we know it the same way that we know that the banks are not going to give our money to another member of their bank, because these are controlled and they're accountable records. And as long as they have your name on them, they're not going to be their inventory records will show zero when they get down to just your stocks. Practice ordering stock during disaster exercise to test the prime vendor and suppliers. Plans are great. They want to see that you've actually went ahead and ordered supplies, not a lot of them, just a sample, to make sure that your vendor could meet the transportation and the time frames to get the supplies to you. And evaluate feasibility and availability of requesting supply support from other healthcare organizations during disasters. Once again, consider that burn rate of supplies relating to disaster operations, because the burn rate looks nothing like your normal consumption rates. Lauren, next slide. Element of Performance 3, the EOP described how the hospital will obtain and replenish non-medical supplies required through response recovery phases of an emergency. Now, for this presentation, I put basically the same types of things. No need for me to go through all these. But the whole idea is to share information with all of those, your oxygen providers, your diesel fuel providers for your emergency backup generator, anything that you're going to need, your food people, anything you're going to need to keep that hospital clean, to keep that hospital supplied, to keep the people fed, to keep the, you know, so environmental service directors, facilities managers are definitely brought into the requirements developing for non-medical entities. Next slide. Performance 4. The EOP describes how the hospital will share resources and assets with other healthcare organizations within the community. Now, there may not be much to share because all hospitals, as we talked about here, are pretty much in a very lean, mean paradigm right now for stocks. And so a lot of that verbiage comes from the days when, you know, those good old days when everybody would share with everybody else when we had a back order, other people would help us out and everything. And I think that the mentality is still there. It's just that there's not enough to share. And so the burn rates will take all hospitals in any given jurisdiction to zero balances pretty quick. But anyway, in the EOP, you really want to show that you have memorandums of agreements or memorandums of understanding for sharing supplies, equipment, services. Might even be for instance, assist with resupply of specialty materials for those organizations like burn centers and stuff, might be able to help, may have sufficient inventories to provide some of those to outlying hospitals to keep them operating. Resupply satellite centers, assist with resupply of alternative care centers. For instance, specialty care centers may be able to assist your organization with the specialty items that they have that would keep your alternative care center up and running, if you have an alternative care center, I should say. Lauren, next slide. Consider arrangements with out-of-area healthcare organizations to share supplies, equipment, and services with out-of-area with your healthcare organization. For instance, when your healthcare organization transfers patients, you might also consider transferring supplies and equipment along with the patient. I think that's going to be the new paradigm in patient transfers and evacuations, is because you send a patient who's on a certain regimen of medicines and supplies and even equipment, it would be, you know, you want to do a lot of coordination with those referral centers that you're setting up in your EOP to either make sure that they will in fact have the supplies and the equipment to sustain that patient when they get there, or you're right into your own plan that when you send the patient, you send a 24-hour or whatever you consider to be reasonable supply cache with that person, so that make sure that person does not end up at a new place without any support. And I'd also ask you to consider arrangements with the Veterans Administration medical centers and with any armed forces hospitals and medical centers that are near you. This, again, like Steve was pointing out, this is all kind of new, but I'm telling you, where it's really going to is going to a complete community organic response to any future disaster. So there'll be no more islands, so to speak, where you do one thing, public health does another, emergency management's doing another, the military people are taking care of their people, and the Veterans Administration are taking care of the veterans. It's going to be the whole community is going to need to come together. So I look for that in the out years from Joint Commission. Element of performance number 5, the EOP describes how the hospital will share these resources and assets with organizations outside the community. Coordinate within network hospitals outside your area to deploy materials. If you have a health system and you have hospitals around the country, it makes sense to have an EOC, Emergency Operations Center, set up at corporate, and they would basically be in good condition to be coordinating with the materials managers at the various levels and their prime vendors to basically keep those supplies coming your way. And the same thing would be on if you were on the giving end. Sub-state region healthcare committees for redistribution of available supplies and equipment. Many states, and that's usually done through the public health organization, through their bioterrorism coordinator, they'll have what they call sub-state or regional healthcare committees for the number of regions they have within that state, and that's a good network to patch into for planning, for coordination, and for even resupplying. And with healthcare associations for redistribution of supplies, depending on the how active your healthcare association is, they may be a very good resource also. Element of performance 6, describes how the hospital will monitor quantities of its resources and assets during emergencies. I always recommend keeping your inventory on your existing inventory management system. Most inventory management systems allow you to have as many departments as you want. So I would set that up as an emergency management response department, and all supplies coming in and going out would be coming in and going out of that department. And the physical location could be somewhere else, could be in the storeroom. But the reason for that, I think, is that it gives total asset visibility to your logistics chief, who will be your materials manager or supply chain manager, while he or she is at the hospital command center. That way it helps maintain situational awareness of on-hand and on-order materials, and it allows you to implement prime vendor and other supplier plans to redeploy materials from distribution centers. It uses accountable records. Your system basically would be an accountable record to help with FEMA, public assistance, when they come in. So they're going to want to come in, and at the very end, I'm going to give you a resource that I highly, highly recommend that you read, because it gives all the different types of things that FEMA considers to be reimbursable and after a disaster, the things they will pay for, the things they won't pay for. And I think Mr. Wasserman will be talking about some of his experiences. Anyway, next slide, Lauren, sorry. Element number 9, the EOP describes the hospital's arrangements for transporting some of the patients and medicines, supplies, equipment, and staff to alternative care sites. Again, more preparedness things, more things that are done well ahead of a disaster, memorandum of understanding or agreements with area and out-of-area hospital supply specialty centers, with EMS organizations for patient transport. Emergency management committee develops patient evacuation, patient transfer protocols, including this next slide, the hospital emergency management committee develops patient evacuation, patient transfer protocols, including evacuation decision and processes, HIPAA compliance measures during disasters, quantities of days of supplies transferred with the patients, if any, patient equipment to be transferred, communicating patient medical needs to gaining hospital, communicating other special patient needs if applicable, protection of patients in transport, safeguarding and accountability, accounting for rather control medical items during transport. Special needs populations and special needs people would be put in that category too. Please note that one thing I really want to bring up here is you'll see in the hospital preparedness program guidance coming out next August at the latest from the Health and Human Services Department. We'll talk about evacuating the healthcare facility. That, as Steve brought up, is a result of the New Orleans disaster, and it truly was a multiple part disaster. Evacuating the facility, healthcare facility, is your last resort. Your materials manager, your environmental services person, your plant operations person, all three should be concentrating on the mitigation, harden that hospital, protect that hospital, try to operate so that you can defend that hospital in place during disasters and come out the other end. Evacuation with professionals, the rescue people, the fire people, the EMS people, is if it has to be done, should be done by them if possible, because they know how to evacuate patients downstairs safely. So anytime I see patient evacuation, I have like a flashback, like it was a post-traumatic stress disorder, because it's one of the most dangerous thing you can do from almost any standpoint you look at it, including once you clear out the hospital, you're likely to never see that hospital operating again. There's a good chance of that. Now back to next slide. It will be element of performance 10, Lauren. Thank you. The EOP describes the hospital's arrangements for transferring pertinent information, including essential clinical and medical-related information, to alternative care sites. MOAs, MOUs with area and sub-state regional healthcare organizations on patient records transfers, electronic and manual, along with the patient, patient management plan, coordination of patient needs. That's really a good place to have those kind of things already standardized at your sub-state region hospital planning groups. Special needs patients need to be thought about and dealt with. Even in alternative care centers, you're going to have you're going to need basically a full set of standards that are very similar to what you have in the hospital, because you'll be providing care. You need to be providing care the way you would to the extent that you can in the hospital. And requirements for alternative care centers should be like interpreters, communications, and then also next of kin information and HIPAA protocols for those centers. Element of performance 12, hospital implements components of the EOP that require advanced preparation to provide resources. Incorporate the emergency operation plan into normal operations for much better results. Practice the capabilities you've developed. Integrate HICS, Hospital Incident Command System, into everyday operation to the maximum extent possible. Daily operations reflect emergency operations. Teams practice emergency management by performing their everyday duties. The more you can line up your everyday duties with your emergency procedures, the better it's going to go for you in an actual emergency. Practice the capabilities you have. The inventory management system functions the same in normal and emergency operations. Accountable records are accountable records, and they will document what you use during that disaster, and that'll be helpful during the recovery stage and the reimbursement stage. Drills and exercise, use minimum simulation. Place some orders with your prime vendors or with your maybe order an extra cylinder of gas if just to make sure that they can be brought up to speed. You have contacts that are still up, they're still relevant. Sometimes people change, sometimes vendors change their emergency operation number. So it's good to test that during every one of your exercises. Use your MOAs and MOUs to solve everyday problems. Use it like you would in a disaster. And I would request the prime vendors redeploy supplies in an exercise just to see that they can do that from one area outside the area of affected area into the drill or exercise area. And hospitals use EOP procedures when transferring patients. Another thing I like to recommend is that you consider working with the Red Cross for every one of your drives to have a blood drive in concert with that drill or exercise, and it's a great way for the Red Cross to be linked to you in real time and get the community people used to the idea that when there's a disaster, there will be blood drives and there'll be other things that will be happening at the same time. Finally, the materials manager, that may be the difference between the organization's survival and closure. The materials manager is going to have to get involved in a way that they never had to before. The buck stops with the materials manager and at that person's door. Every department benefits from the materials manager's knowledge of contracting. So there'll be a lot of involvement, not just with the presentation I gave today, but every part of that every part of the new 2009 Joint Commission standards. The old emergency management paradigm is, you know, past the Joint Commission, and the new paradigm is going to be the healthcare organization is the community's castle. Harden it, fortify it, and sustain it and its staff so the community survives and recovers along with the hospital. Now, this last page, if you would, Lauren, is for disaster assistance. I highly recommend that you look at the 9500 series policy publications from FEMA. That website is there. You can cut it and paste it to your browser, and you're going to be amazed at how many 9500 documents there are. But they really are not hard to read, and they're very helpful as you plan for what types of things would FEMA require for documentation in order to get you the most award that you can possibly, you know, get. And I just came back from Galveston, and I was deployed there as a contractor for FEMA, and I was gung-ho, but the problem was that it looks like Galveston is not reconstituting its healthcare organization, and it was a very, very sad thing for me to look through or to live through, because I really was there to help, and I had in my mind going in that we were going to very quickly be able to start issuing some money, and it looks like, for those of you that are in Texas, you know better than I do, Galveston Healthcare Services will be a long time coming back to where they were, if it ever gets back there. So please do check out those FEMA slides. Laura, I'll take it back to you, and I'm sorry, I probably went over a little bit.
That's fine. Now we're going to get ready and get started with the third presentation. And with that said, do we have Mark on the line?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Lauren, very much. I've just lost my here it is. Hopefully I have control of the slides now, so we'll see if this works. If not, Lauren, you can just follow along with me.
Will do.
Thank you, Lauren. I very much appreciate the opportunity from you and from all the folks at Premier for the opportunity to share the story of New York City. And really, while I was at St. Vincent's Hospital, this is the story of all of the hospitals in New York. One of the untold stories of 9/11 is still the work that was done at hospitals. I think if I were to ask everybody who's participating today how many people you think went to hospitals, if you think back to the video of those days, you would probably think about several hundred or maybe 1,000 people went to the hospitals. Well, when we did a study of all of the hospital associations, more than 108 hospitals were involved and over 7,000 people were registered at hospitals. But it's important to note that the story I am going to tell is really the story of all of the hospitals in New York and all the work that was done, even though my experience was at St. Vincent's. Lauren, I cannot control these slides, so I'm going to ask you to do it and just follow along with me if you would. On September 11th, 2001, St. Vincent's Hospital was part of the St. Vincent Catholic Medical Center system. We were 8 acute care hospitals in 4 boroughs of New York. We had a large behavioral health system, 4 nursing homes, 3 home health care agencies. St. Vincent's Manhattan was the academic medical center for New York Medical College. We had $1.6 billion in revenue, and St. Vincent's in Manhattan, it's important that you understand, was the closest level 1 trauma center to the World Trade Center. On our next slide, you'll see that St. Vincent's, much like every hospital that's represented here today, went through a lot of internal disaster drills twice a year. In New York City, we're fortunate, though, to have the opportunity to work with our City Office of Emergency Management, part of the Mayor's Office, and really had great experience working with them even before 9/11. In New York, we're also very fortunate to be part of the Greater New York Hospital Association, which really closely coordinates all the region-wide hospital and healthcare efforts for hospitals as we plan for disasters. We've, at St. Vincent's, because of our location in Lower Manhattan, though, had supplies with other disasters, including the first bombing of the World Trade Center. And from those, we learned a lot. We learned about communications issues, supply delivery, citywide traffic, and citywide inter-hospital communications, the absolute necessity to be working together with all of the hospitals. Let me take you back, if I may, for just a few minutes to September 11th, 2001, at 8:46 a.m. Put down your pencils for a few minutes and just go back with me in time. At St. Vincent's Catholic Medical Center, our system CEO, David Campbell, was holding a meeting with his hospital presidents, the presidents of all 8 hospitals in the boardroom of St. Vincent's Manhattan. Literally, we heard the plane fly overhead and then a loud thump. Our emergency room director, Joe Davis, informed us that EMS had declared a major disaster immediately. Disaster plans, as they were called at the time, were activated and incident command centers were opened in all 8 of our hospitals because, providentially, all of those presidents were in the same room at the same time. 14 of St. Vincent's paramedics and 7 of our ambulances and hundreds of other first responders were dispatched immediately to Lower Manhattan. This photo, as it comes up on your screen, was taken by one of our hospital photographers from right in front of our hospital emergency room on 7th Avenue. It shows that what we saw, this is not a telephoto lens, what we saw from right in front of our hospital, that gaping hole in front of the World Trade Center North Tower, and the smoke hasn't even gotten to the top of the frame and that beautiful blue sky that none of us will ever forget from September 11th. In the first hour on our next slide, you'll see that St. Vincent's Manhattan activated its Incident Command Center, as it was called at the time, opened 6 auxiliary emergency rooms, moved all of our ER patients upstairs, launched an automatic order system for extra supplies, and we'll talk about that as we go, set up a triage teams, stretchers and wheelchairs right on 7th Avenue as the full we went into full trauma center major disaster mode. Mayor Giuliani, in his book called Leadership, writes on one of the pages that he really didn't recognize the magnitude of what was happening because of the stories were so varied until his car took him by St. Vincent's as he was headed towards the World Trade Center, and he saw what he called these major trauma teams on the street on 7th Avenue. At that point, he knew that this was something far more than he had been told. Our first patients arrived at St. Vincent's by subway, taxi, and even passenger car, really letting us know that many more people were on the way. But then, unbelievably, the first ambulance pulled up, opened doors, and there were 8 horrifically burned patients in that first ambulance. And so it continued. Then the second plane hit the South Tower, and we and all of America, indeed all of the world, knew this was much more than an accident. The photo that's going to come up on your screen in just a moment may look like confusion to some people, but those of you involved in this kind of preparedness know that this is what I call a well-choreographed ballet of office workers, housekeepers, nutrition workers, and health professionals working together to bring all of the patients out from the street, triage them, and bring them to the right area of the hospital. As the second hour continued on our next slide, we'll see that more patients arrived at St. Vincent's Hospital in our trauma centers, and others begin to be transported by boat to other hospitals in Manhattan, other hospitals, and some by boat to hospitals on Staten Island, and still others arrive in Brooklyn and Queens, traveling by taxi, bus, and even walking over the Brooklyn and Manhattan bridges to healthcare facilities that they could find. Off-duty employees, physicians, and nurses began to arrive, and as you work on your plan, it's really important that you have as part of that plan the discipline that has to be built in for the employees who automatically want to come to work and help but need to stay home so they can be prepared for that second shift 12 hours later. Really a very important nuance that must be followed. Then the South Tower collapsed. One of our ambulances was destroyed. 2 others were damaged, and our 14 paramedics were missing. I pause here for just a minute because it's important to remember that on that day, 9 paramedics from hospitals died. 32 Port Authority police officers lost their lives. 34 New York City police officers never returned to their precinct. And 353 of New York's finest, our firefighters, were lost going into those buildings to help others, first responders who will never, ever be forgotten. This photo, which will come up in just a moment, shows what it looked like just after the first tower collapsed. This photo, taken from one of our patient rooms, shows the smoldering embers coming up from the ground as well from the building that remained standing. But remember what I just said. This photo was taken from a patient room. We all have to remember that it's not just the patients coming into the trauma center that we have to deal with. It's all of our patients upstairs and their families and loved ones who are very, very concerned, particularly when your hospital, like New York Downtown Hospital or St. Vincent's, are so very close to the actual event. Family members are going to worry desperately about their loved ones who are already inpatients in the facility. So please take a few minutes to think about that as you prepare all of your plans as well. The photo on the next page shows one of our paramedics helped by a civilian going past one of our partially destroyed ambulances, helping yet another civilian out of the rubble after the first building had collapsed. You'll notice all of the papers on the ground that had come out of that building as it collapsed, file folders, papers, envelopes, all over Lower Manhattan, as well as the lives of thousands and thousands of people. As the second hour continued, we see in our next slide that patients continued to stream into the Manhattan Trauma Center and St. Vincent's other emergency rooms around our system, as well as hospitals throughout the tri-state area. special sites were set up on Liberty Island and other areas throughout the area to help the more than 7,000 injured people who needed help. And then, as I was standing on 7th Avenue, I was in front of a podium beginning to deal with all of the press, and I heard sirens coming from Midtown, not from the downtown area where all the ambulances were coming from. I said to myself, my God, why are they sending us another patient from another area? But it wasn't patients. These were New York City and New York State police officers escorting trucks, 18-wheelers full of extra equipment and supplies that had those orders that had gone in automatically began to arrive. St. Vincent's is not a burn center, but if it were not for the burn packs in that first truck that arrived, I dare say many more people would have died that day. But those extra supplies that were on those automatic orders and our supply chain officers who had worked so hard to prepare all of that really came into play, and many lives were saved. The morning continued, and then the North Tower collapsed, and it all began again, the smoke, the debris, the ash coming over St. Vincent's and other hospitals in Lower Manhattan. But then the media began to arrive, and we found ourselves in the middle of an amazing situation. This next photo that you'll see is a photo that was taken immediately after the second building collapsed, again from that same patient room. Our patients upstairs seeing all this unfold in front of their eyes. And where there was once a proud two buildings, now there was a gaping hole in the sky of Lower Manhattan. As I said, and you'll see in our next photo, the media began to arrive, and this was just the beginning of that arrival. It soon took over a full block across the street from the hospital. And a very important part of all of your plans must be to make sure that you have a good media plan in place. In our next slide, you'll see Mayor Giuliani actually gave his first press briefing at St. Vincent's after he had walked up from downtown and been caught in the rubble and debris in one of the buildings, and spoke to the White House at a firehouse, and then came immediately to St. Vincent's. But a very important part of your disaster planning efforts must be planning for the media, and I'm very briefly on our next slide touch on that you really need to have a carefully designed media plan put into place. Keep the media in one place by providing them with all that they need, constant information, one voice, good visuals, and frequent interviews with experts in various fields. Our media area, which we had pre-planned, was immediately across the street from where our emergency room entrance was. So they had good visuals. We kept coming out with paramedics and surgeons and others who were caring for patients, so they had no need to go anywhere else. They never got into our emergency room, and if there's one thing we're all very proud of that day, is that there was no media ever saw a patient while they were being cared for. There were good visuals, frequent interviews with experts in various fields, easy access to the visiting dignitaries. Of course, we all know when the mayor or the governor pulled up, when they see those TV cameras, where they're going first. We had coordination with city, state, and federal spokespersons, making sure we were all speaking with one voice, and working with Greater New York Hospital Association and the AHA, making sure that we were even coordinating our voice and our message with that at the White House. We worked closely with all of those spokespersons, but most importantly, we're proud of the honesty and integrity and the fact that we kept patient and family privacy sacrosanct that day. We provided the media with everything they need, and thus they were able to do their jobs and let us do ours. On the next slide, you'll see that as the third hour continued, patients continued to arrive by foot and by bus, boat, ambulance, even passenger cars at our hospital and other hospitals throughout the tri-state area. These numbers I can show you from all of our patient records are actual numbers. At St. Vincent's Manhattan, we received more than 450 patients in the first 2 hours. St. Vincent's Staten Island received more than 200. New York Downtown Hospital received many hundreds as well. But then if you read your standards very closely, the Joint Commission encourages you to plan for disasters within the disaster. And that happened at St. Vincent's on 9/11. Our water pressure dropped to dangerously low levels because we are on the main line to Lower Manhattan. And think about those hundreds of firefighters, thousands of firefighters who are pouring water onto that fire. We were soon finding ourselves in a situation where we didn't have enough water to even run our suction and our air conditioning units. Mayor Giuliani stopped by the hospital for the second time shortly after that, asked what he could do, and through the emergency management system, arranged for tanker trucks of water to be brought in to constantly augment our supply, an augmentation that was needed for 6 full weeks while the water pressure remained low. But then the siren stopped, and the patients stopped arriving. On our next page, you'll see that our doctors and nurses and others continued to wait outside with the hope that more and more patients would be arriving. But on the next slide, you'll see that the patients remained empty. The stretchers remained empty because there were not enough patients yet to come. On our next slide, we'll talk about the second wave of patients. We all know that there, in many disasters, is a plan for the second wave of patients. Physicians, nurses, administrators waited, while only a modest number of additional survivors continued to arrive. But at that point, a very interesting and amazing thing happened. Neighbors and other New Yorkers began to surround our hospital. The New York City Police Department estimated from their helicopters that nearly 25,000 people surrounded St. Vincent's, not in an intimidating way, but wanting to help. All New Yorkers needed to do something. Indeed, all Americans felt the need to do something. And on our next slide, you'll see a photo of an ingenious New Yorker, not a St. Vincent's employee, but just a neighbor who wrote on a piece of oak tag, "Blood donors, line up here." And in the next photo, you'll see another New Yorker took a broomstick and a brown paper bag and started lining up patients by individuals by their blood type. And so they lined themselves up, O positive, O negative, A positive, A negative. For two city blocks, people were lined up by their blood type, and they offered to give blood. We couldn't take that blood at that time, but Mayor Giuliani arranged for buses to take some of those people to other sites where blood could be taken. And yet, there was never enough. And as was said before, it's so important to involve the Red Cross in all of our efforts and making sure that there's plenty of blood on site at all times. As the afternoon went on, we'll see in our next slide that the New York City OEM Command Center collapsed with Building 7 of the World Trade Center. At that point, Greater New York expanded its command center and began helping in many ways to coordinate all the efforts of the entire tri-state area. Part of our disaster plan, as I know yours is a family center. But thousands of family members began to arrive at our hospital and at other hospitals throughout Lower Manhattan, or began to call us in an effort to locate their loved ones. Our small family center became overwhelmed, and in another wonderful gesture by a neighbor, the New School University offered their entire student center. So that quickly became the area where families were sent to go see, with laptop computers and other information we had. There were lines, blocks long, of people trying to get information. And at that point, the Greater New York Hospital Association helped us tremendously by making sure that information was available from other hospitals as well. But as families began to realize that their loved ones couldn't be found, literally within hours, they went home to their computers and started making little signs with photos of their loved ones. And they were plastered all over St. Vincent's and all over New York, these signs that we'll never forget, looking for their loved one. And when the days went by and they realized they couldn't find their loved ones or they wouldn't be found, those signs were changed just to look for someone who might have seen their loved one in their final moments, wanting to know how their loved ones died, wanting to know where they were when those horrible buildings collapsed. On our next slide, you'll see that in the days that followed, we registered more than 6,400 families in our family center just looking for their loved ones. Greater New York Hospital Association coordinated the sharing of patient information citywide, getting the names of patients at all of the hospitals in the region and working with New York City OEM to set up a website where families could go and get information about their loved ones. Grief and trauma counseling were expanded. And more than 10,000 calls, we can document this, were all received at our emergency phone center. Volunteers, food, clothing, blood donors continued to flood the hospital. And if there's one thing that we may not prepare for, and I urge you to think about this, it's all of the volunteers and the food and clothing and blood donors who will rush to your hospital to try to help. We need to be prepared even for that scenario. In the weeks that followed, firefighters, police officers, and rescue workers continued to arrive from Ground Zero with injuries, including eye abrasions, fractures, and breathing difficulties. And I'll never forget one very burly construction worker who came in and with his construction hat under his arms and a dazed look in his eye. And the nurses began to care for him, thinking that he had an eye abrasion. But it was one of our pastoral care workers who really got this fella to start talking. And this was a backhoe worker He ran a backhoe his entire life, and he went downtown to see if he could help with his backhoe. And as he was digging into the ground, instead of digging up dirt, he started seeing body parts, arms and legs. It's not just the physical wellness of our patients that we have to care for. It's the psychological damage that is done not only to the patients and the victims, but to those who are the first responders and construction workers who will help in all of these events. We need to make sure we're taking care of every aspect of the whole person as they come into our emergency rooms. Then, a few weeks later, the anthrax scares began. And as anthrax was confirmed in the media offices and post offices, patients arrived by hundreds seeking testing. Citywide coordination by the Greater New York Hospital Association again and the City Department of Health really worked with us to make sure that we were able to continue helping patients through all of this. It's important to know in our next slide that these numbers were just for St. Vincent's, but as I said, citywide, the numbers were even more dramatic. More than 1,400 patients were seen in our 8 emergency rooms. We had 148 admissions, 6,900 visits to family centers, 16,000 calls to crisis lines, more than 1,200 visits for anthrax concerns in the months that followed, and 248 anthrax tests conducted. More than 20,000 individuals continue to this day, nearly 8 years later, to undergo counseling conducted by the St. Vincent's Behavioral Health Service Division. Truly an amazing statistic when we think about all those who continue to need care. Citywide, as I said, more than 7,300 patients were seen in emergency rooms in the tri-state area. There were 712 admissions, nearly 27,000 visits to family centers, nearly 400,000 calls to crisis lines, and 2,900 visits for anthrax concerns. There were 482 anthrax tests conducted in New York City alone, and the New York Times has estimated that over 500,000 New Yorkers are still suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, while only 100,000 individuals are undergoing ongoing counseling. I share these numbers with you, whether you're in a small town or a big city. The magnitude of this disaster cannot be overspoken about. Whether you live near a college that has a campus that might have a facility that holds 15,000 people, think about if there's an airborne pathogen during a basketball game. The numbers of people will be staggering. So whether you're in a small community or a large community, you have to be prepared for whatever will come. We have to understand that there were enormous financial consequences. St. Vincent Catholic Medical Center expended or lost revenue totaling more than $25 million in those weeks. There were citywide health care costs over $500 million. And after 12 months of aggressive advocacy by Greater New York and others, HRSA released the harsh $140 million in funding to hospitals. But every hospital received $1 million, whether they were a block away, or 12 blocks away, or 12 miles away. They all received the same amount of money. It took many more months, and finally St. Vincent's received a total of $22 million. And philanthropic gifts increased dramatically, and then we began and continued our nuclear, biological, and chemical terrorism preparedness. We learned a lot of lessons, as can be seen on the next slide. We learned about the special attention that must be given to other patients and their families, community members, and your employees. Most importantly, your employees. What they will see and feel and touch in those days will be unprecedented, and you need to make sure you take care of every one of your employees. I think of my secretary who helped me for days until a day and a half later, the firefighter chaplain came and told her that her firefighter husband, Frank Santor, died as he went up the steps of the World Trade Center. Think about it. Many of our emergency room nurses and other workers meet their spouses in the emergency room, and they're firefighters and other first responders. So we have to make sure that all of our employees, particularly our emergency room employees, are well cared for during those days. We all need better policies on volunteers and blood donors, better policies on sharing patient information, access to emergency areas. And I don't mean your emergency room. I'm talking about the next day or 3 days later when there's National Guardsmen with M16 rifles several blocks away that won't let a patient who needs chemotherapy into your hospital. You need to have arrangements made with your other care centers or other hospitals to provide care even in the days and weeks that follow, because patients will not be able to get to your facility. We need to make sure that there's additional communication needs that are well addressed. Business interruption insurance, not only for the hospital, but for our physicians as well. And the challenges of obtaining government funding are legion. We need to accelerate our preparedness for the next attack, and there will be a next attack, and we must be ready. We need to make sure that we, in the old parlance, have all hazards preparedness, ongoing preparedness for our system, our communities. Working with our communities, as was said before, is sacrosanct and most important now to the Joint Commission. We need to make sure that our system is working closely with our regional hospital associations, the city and area, county departments of health, of course, with our state hospital association, AHA, JACO, and other areas must be worked with very closely. And as we go to our next slide, we see that we need to make sure we're working regionally and in our communities, as was said before, working with our hospital association, our Office of Emergency Management, constantly develop new EMS protocols. And we need to make sure that we're enhancing redundant communication systems so that we can continue to work with all of our colleagues throughout our areas. We need to improve data sharing systems that enhance surveillance and detection, identify access capacity, and the needed resources to establish a regional patient locator system. We need to develop region-wide pharmaceutical stockpiles, and many of those have been developed but need to continue to be developed. We have a system-wide preparedness committee at St. Vincent's that continues with the help of the Greater New York Hospital Association and others to develop new protocols for incorporating the hospitals and nursing homes disaster plans. We focus in on staff training, pharmaceuticals, medical supplies, and facility needs, and this has all cost St. Vincent's about $10 million in the years since 2001. We have system-wide preparedness, as is seen on our next slide, that are continuing to work on NBC protocols, pharmaceuticals, push packs, pre-push packs in our emergency rooms and in our ambulances. We have training for our first responders and all of our staff. We continue to provide personal protective equipment for all of our employees and make sure that communications with our employees and our neighbors is most important. On our next slide, you'll see that we'll continue to work closely with our regional, state, and national preparedness efforts. We were visited by the Joint Commission in the weeks that followed 9/11, several times actually, and they came back to us, and we worked very closely with them on the new standards, growing from our experience. And through that, we hope that we've had the opportunity to help prepare whatever hospital is next in assuring that we are all prepared. And we do this in a spirit of making sure that there is hope and remembrance, a spirit of hope for what may come next, a hope that we are all prepared for whatever events may happen, and a remembrance of all 3,000 people who lost their lives on September 11th, 2001. Thank you, Lauren, and thank you all.
Thank you, Mark. That was great. I think we'll go straight into our question and answer session. Ashley, are you there? Can you tell folks how to ask questions again?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, if you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. And we do have a question from the line of Linda Dorsey Walker with Health Card Paradigm.
First of all, I want to thank the gentleman that just finished speaking. I was greatly moved. And as a person who went down to Hurricane Katrina after that tragedy and saw the aftermath and was a service center manager, I can see that what we went through may have in many ways pale next to the emergency situations that you went through. However, my question deals with the fact that, as the previous speaker, Mr. Rush, said, in many areas throughout Mississippi and Texas and Louisiana, the healthcare system still has never recovered. So even though all these lessons are learned, there is no individual or group of individuals in the hospitals that did reopen, and not all of them did, to put many of these lessons learned into place. What are they to do the next time?
Um, Jim or whoever's on the line who wants an answer?
Mark? Lauren, I can take this. The most important thing is that every chief executive officer, every chief nursing officer, every department manager in every hospital needs to, and I know that there's so many challenges, there's just so many challenges to the executive leadership of hospitals, but the most important thing to get us past where we're at is get past that denial that it's not going to happen to us and get themselves into a mindset of readiness. And there's plenty of information, like Mark just brought up, wonderful presentation, and they have learned an awful lot from their experience on 9/11. So, you know, I wish there were more emphasis placed from the executive associations, like the one I belong to is the American College for healthcare executives, I think we just need to stress to everybody it can happen to you. It will probably happen it one way or another sooner or later. So build those preparedness steps, make those connections with area hospitals, build yourself a network that will fortify your healthcare castle. That's what I've been preaching.
I think there's a number of people out there like Jim and myself and the people at Premier who are willing to help at your hospitals if you feel you don't have the resources to, number one, prepare yourselves and your communities for whatever may come, whether it's man-made or God-made disaster, but also prepare for Joint Commission, and you should avail yourself of people like Jim and others who are willing to help.
Ashley, are there more questions?
And again, that is star, then the number one on your telephone keypad to ask a question.
I've got one that was chatted in, and maybe, Mark, you might want to answer this. It's pretty broad, but it's, what is the medical staff's role in disaster planning?
Well, I certainly hope that they play a very key role. We were fortunate at St. Vincent, fortunate or unfortunate, that we have been through a number of disasters. Particularly the first World Trade Center bombing. And from that moment on, every physician came to every disaster drill, came to every meeting we had about preparedness. And the medical staff actually, in their elected officers, formed a committee on preparedness, working closely with the administration. I know sometimes it takes that kind of difficult situation to make things happen, like we don't get red lights in intersections until there's fatalities. But hopefully in sharing our story, we can encourage others and other clinicians to be involved.
Is there anybody waiting, Ashley?
And I am showing, we do have a follow-up question from the line of Linda Dorsey Walker with HealthCard Paradigm.
Yes, well, the entire presentation given today, including the audio portion that was so rich, be viewable later on, or will it only simply be the visual portion?
No, everything, including the audio, will be available tomorrow morning. And if you registered, I have everybody's email addresses, and I'll send out a follow-up email with information on how to access everything. I've got a couple questions coming in here. Are there any checklists available for the recovery phase? Jim?
Let me think here. Well, you know, I don't have a checklist. Well, let me put it this way. I'm developing a checklist for a complete review of a healthcare organization's emergency operation plan. Now, that is being automated right now through our IT folks. And you know, I think what they're asking for is if there's something out there that's non-proprietary. That's a really good question. I'm trying to take a quick look for the Joint Commission. In fact, I think probably the Joint Commission webpage should be looked at, and also the be looked at for the community response. They have a brochure, a booklet that is that addresses the community involvement, and in there, there's recovery aspects of it.
Okay, well, also, if somebody out there on the line has something like this that exists, they can get it to me after the call,
yeah.
And I can post information. If people want to share information on this call, I can post it with all the other materials.
Yeah. And I'll take a look, too, and see if I have something that addresses strictly recovery operations. Thanks. That was a very good question. Recovery is a very important part.
Do you have more to add, Mark?
It's multifaceted in that you've got to look at business continuity. You also need to look at the facility in terms of almost recommissioning it as a new facility, depending on what type of disaster, certainly post-hurricane or some type of major natural disaster that would impact the facility. You really have to go through and test those systems and make sure they're fully operational before you start providing patient care again. And that's one of the things the American Society of Healthcare Engineering is working on, developing some checklists for commissioning post-disaster and recovery phase.
Great. I've got a good question here that was chatted in, and Mark's, and I think this might be a good one for you to answer. Could someone comment on the role of the human resources administrators in emergency planning? This person represents those professionals.
I saw that question, too, and I'm glad you asked me to comment on it. The human resources people are absolutely paramount, along with the nursing executives. As I said during my comments, it's really important to, number one, make sure everyone knows where they're supposed to be. We had 6 auxiliary emergency rooms in our plan. Everybody knew where to go. We had people helping with the triage on the street. There needs to be enormous planning ahead of time for the magnitude of disasters that we can all face, and also to have the discipline for those employees who are home to stay home, and a mechanism with your local radio stations and other forms of communication to communicate with those people, whether it's a telephone tree or emails or blast emails, to make sure they stay home, they get rest, and they're ready for the second 12-hour shift. It's so very important. And I might just add also for your volunteer offices, St. Vincent's has set up a volunteer corps just for disasters. There are people out there who want to help desperately but just don't have the time to volunteer every week or every month. But in times of disaster, they want to be there. And so we have specially trained people who can't volunteer all the time but who have been well prepared in the event of a disaster to come and know what their assignment is.
Right.
The only thing I'd like to add to that is one of the things from Katrina that really came out was one of the big problems from a human resources perspective was the rumor mill that was going on within the facility and about what was happening outside the facility in the community, which was fueling concerns about family members. And so one of the facilities that I've spoken with on frequent occasions lost a lot of staff because they were so concerned about their families, they just decided that that's where their loyalties were.
Steve, here's a question I think you might be able to address while you're talking. Does the 96-hour supply only apply to only the hospital facility proper, or can your system distribution center count for the 96-hour supply?
Well, it depends on how you interpret the standards, but the way the Joint Commission and the way the surveyors that I've spoken with look at it as a hospital entity, because it's a campus sort of thing. In an event like a hurricane or a tornado or something, it may impact your ability to move supplies and people within the community. Then that 96-hour supply is specifically to that unit. Now, if one of my colleagues wants to comment or disagree, this is one of those things that's still under consideration, I guess, by the Joint Commission.
It's a very, very good point you make. The 96 hours, if you were to use the requirements worksheet and you go down there and you see what your requirements are likely to be for each of the I thought I put this thing on mute here and it's not doing it for me. Anyway, if you have an alternative care center, if you have a surgical center, the idea is to make sure that you can operate that center for an extended period of time without resupply support. But as far as, requiring healthcare organizations to upfront the money that would entail to get 4 days of unsupported without outside resupply, I think is what they actually say, is going to be a really, really challenge to healthcare organizations and a real problem for them. So One of the things I've been telling my folks that is that, you know, if you can get funding through your hospital preparedness program to support inventory management, vendor management programs, then you could actually bring the inventory into your hospital if you have the space, and then have your vendor come in and stock rotate your inventory in place. That's a possibility. So you need to talk with your public health people in terms of what the hospital preparedness program will allow and won't allow for grant monies. But that's one way you could do it, is where your vendor would come in and rotate the stock, and then the stocks would be paid for initially through a hospital grant program. So that's what I would be really exploring hard if I were out there in the hospital.
Yeah, what's interesting is the Joint Commission says you need to be self-sufficient for 96 hours, but then in a note at the same EP, it says that does not mean that you're required to stockpile materials. So it's interesting in how you would comply with that element of performance if you don't in some way stockpile some materials.
Well, we used to have a thing we called operational projects in the armed forces. And so that's where we come into what I'm calling vendor-managed inventory. And it's a known entity. But basically, if you say, for instance, if you got $500,000 from the Hospital Preparedness Program grant, and you had a vendor, we'll say Cardinal or McKesson or Owens & Minor, and you said, okay, I want you to, and using your HVA, and these are the three likely events, and these are the items that we decided we're going to need for 4 days of unsustained supply support. And we want these items, we want to purchase these items, we want you to store them, we want you to put on your accountable records that these belong to us, these have to be auditable, or have to pass an audit, and we want those pushed directly to us as soon as we call. And then maybe do a test and then keep a 2% of that away for tests or whatever and call forward maybe 1% or something or 2% during the disaster to see if your prime vendor is holding up their end of the deal. But that's what I would be shooting for is a vendor managed inventory operational project that way you can say if you were looking at a hurricane and you're looking at a terrorist bombing like Madrid, London, and you're looking at an earthquake, and the earthquake occurs, and you say, push forward all of our earthquake supplies, and that way, I think that would meet the Joint Commission standards.
Mark, there was a question. Did you see the question on here from Eugenia Smither? She'd like to know if Greater New York Area participants complete an HVA collectively as described by the first speaker. And if that has helped in their continued planning.
I'm not sure that the hospitals all work together on that, but I know Susan Waltman and others at Greater New York work very closely with all of the hospitals as a whole to make sure that their own are filled out and then Greater New York kind of compiles everything in a very careful private way to make sure that everyone is in sync with each other. They work with hospitals individually, talking to their next-door neighbors and others. And so I can't say there's one giant HVA for all of New York put together by Greater New York, although there may be. I'm not aware of it personally. But I do know they work very closely with the hospitals as a group and then put small groups together to make sure they're working together in each borough. And within others. And there was another question, I guess while I have the floor for a moment, or a comment from Leslie Holt that she believes that the Greater New York Hospital Association, perhaps on their website, has a checklist that was asked for before, a recovery checklist. So people might want to go to GNYHA.org and look on their website.
If Leslie wants to send that to me, too, she'll get my email and a follow-up. She can send it to me, and I can post it on the site for folks as well. We're almost at the end of our time here. I think let's just end with Sandra Yin's question for you, Mark. Knowing what you do now, given your experience with 9/11 and its aftermath, I know this is kind of a broad question, but is there anything that you can pick out that you would do differently from a planning standpoint, maybe something big?
Sure. Well, Sandra, thank you for the question. I I think there's an awful lot that can be done, and as difficult and challenging as the Joint Commission standards are, and we may not agree with them all, I think they really are moving us down the right path, and we need to follow those. We need to make sure our clinicians are involved, that everyone is involved, and if there's any way you can continue to help tell the story of New York and the story of Katrina and the other stories that you've heard, it's important that all of the people in your hospitals hear that so that they continue to participate and get more and more involved. But the hazard vulnerability study is enormously important, and I think what people don't do enough is let their imaginations run wild. Find the biggest gathering place in your community, whether you're in a rural community or in a city or something in between. There is probably a large gathering place where thousands of people can gather, and make sure that you're prepared for whatever that large number of people are in your community. No matter how small your community, you have large gatherings, whether it's churches or school events or colleges or whatever, and you need to be prepared for those numbers of patients, however big that is.
Great advice.
Great. Thank you, everybody. I just want to, we've gone over a few minutes, and we've still got, you know, probably 80% of the people on the line that logged on. If there's questions out there that haven't been answered, you'll get my contact information on the follow-up email. Please feel free to send them to me. I can pass them on to our speakers today, who I'm sure would be willing to communicate either through me or directly with you on any questions you have. Is that correct?
Sure.
Absolutely.
Yep, absolutely. And again, you'll get an email. I'll give you all the details in the next 24 hours of how to find this info. And if the speakers could stay on the line, I just want to thank everybody. And from the, I'm getting comments right now via the chat that this was a very helpful and informative presentation. So thank you again for participating today.
This concludes today's compliance with the Joint Commission's Emergency Management Standards and Lessons Learned from the Frontline on September 11th conference call. You may now disconnect.